Welcome to today's program. I'm Rick Mullaney, the director of the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University, and welcome to a special edition of Policy Matters, WJCT's quarterly radio program that takes a close look at public policy issues that matter to you and to the future of our city, state, and nation. Thanks for being with us. Today, we are very pleased to have this special edition program with the Speaker of the Florida House of Representatives, Richard Corcoran. In his first session earlier this year, his top priorities included education, ethics reform, and financial accountability. We look forward to hearing from him on those and other priorities and the upcoming legislative session. Hope you'll stay with us. Mr. Speaker, welcome to the program, and thanks for being with us.
No, thanks for having me on, Rick. I appreciate it.
It's a welcome to Jacksonville and to North Florida, and a great opportunity for our listeners to get to know you better. So I thought we'd start off by asking, how about just telling us about your personal background and your pathway to becoming Speaker of the House?
Well, I'm married. I met my wife in law school, and we have six kids, age 16 to 5, three boys, three girls. And the pathway to the speakership, I ran in 2010, and it was that big year. It was a Obamacare year. Governor Scott upset Bill McCollum. It was a real, you know, Tea Party movement. And so I think that was really helpful for me, being a very strong conservative. I had a very difficult primary. There was three people in the race. But we were able to come out of it. And then what happened is, because it was the 2010 cycle, I had the second largest class in the history of the legislature. So there's 120 lawmakers. Republicans are teetering just around 80 of those members. Well, my class that got elected was 34 of those 80. So literally, it's you have a freshman, a sophomore, a junior, and a senior class. So literally, the freshmen were almost, you know, half of the entire Republican body. And I think it was because of that movement. And so you saw a lot of people who ordinarily wouldn't run. We had a very successful businessman in Miami who ran, never run for office before, a young prosecutor, all these different types. And so all of us got elected, and it was a very conservative class. And I think because I had experience working with Danny Webster when he was speaker, and Tom Feeney when he was speaker, and then Marco Rubio when he was speaker, I think they gave me the nod to be the speaker for the class. And so it's a great honor. It's been a real pleasure.
I was actually going to mention that you served as chief of staff to Senator, currently U.S. Senator Rubio. He was Speaker of the House at the time, and for three different speakers. Do you believe that that experience has really helped prepare you almost uniquely for the kind of legislative, for the work you're doing in legislation now as speaker?
Yeah, I mean, having that experience and background, you know, you some folks get up there and the first thing they're trying to figure out, and if you've been to the Capitol, it's not an easy place to get around. There's like ramps that go to different buildings. And so the joke is, you know, people are just trying to find the restrooms initially and get their feet wet. So that part of the learning I didn't have. But I will say this, I always say I think 75-80% of what you know, you learn very quickly in the first, you know, 60-90 days. And then it's just incremental after that. And the class was so talented. I mean, if you look at some of the people that are in the class, Carlos Trujillo from Miami, he's now an ambassador to the United Nations and about to be the ambassador to Organization of American States. Matt Gaetz is now a congressman, a regular on Fox News. Daniel Davis, who got elected, is now the head of your Chamber of Commerce, one of the largest chambers in the nation. So all these great, talented people that were in the class, it didn't take any of them long to figure out what was going on and be impactful right away.
Well, clearly, Mr. Speaker, during your tenure in the legislature and clearly during your first session, one of your great passions is public education. How about telling our listeners about your view on K through 12 and, of course, the legislation that came out last spring?
Well, I always say, you know, and this is a debate that I, you know, every now and then I've had it with, had these conversations with Governor Scott, Governor Bush, Senator Rubio. But I think the fundamental question you have to answer is, what's the purpose of an education? If the purpose, and I think what's dangerous is if you say the purpose of an education is to get a job, as opposed to create a well-rounded citizen who can critically think, wrestle with the great questions, cipher through masses amounts of data, and be able to come up with a decision that works, and that produces somebody who's not only just a good citizen, he's a good community leader, a good husband, a good father, or mother and spouse. And so that is really, I think, if you go back in time, I think that was the focus of education all the way up until, you know, the 60s, you know, sort of revolution. And then after that, it's become much more centric on finding a job. And then you lose those great wrestling that people should have with the questions of life. And so I think one of the things that we've pushed and why I'm passionate about it is that if you don't give kids that world-class K-12 education, what you're really robbing them of is a lifetime of hope in many situations. And sometimes even worse, you rob them of their dignity. And so what we found out getting in there and looking at our educational system. And I say this all the time, we're the third largest state and the richest country in the world, and yet we had over 100,000 students who were basically in failure factories, where they go to a school and every single year they're not getting a year's worth of learning, and they graduate, in many cases, functionally illiterate. And you just say to yourself, how is that even possible? How can we be the third largest state and the richest country of the world and produce year after year after year students who are functionally illiterate? And so we went in and we said, how do we change that? And a lot of it is a model is based on Jacksonville. You guys had community leaders, John Baker, Gary Chartrand, who went up to and said, we want KIPP in our low-income area because KIPP has a proven record of success. And so what we did is they bought KIPP to Jacksonville. We looked at that, and now there's models like KIPP all over the country, Success, Idea, Uncommon, KIPP, Seed. And we said to those schools, why won't you come to Florida? They basically said, here's all the reasons, too much regulation, not enough capital money. We put together that bill. It's the, I always say, the most pro-parent, pro-teacher, pro-student public school bill in the history of the state. And I think it's going to have a profound impact on ending the whole concept of failure factories in Florida.
You know, Mr. Speaker, I do want to talk about more specifics on the bill, but I have to say, I saw a speech you gave a while back, and quite frankly, I thought one piece of it was very eloquent. You quoted, I believe, Steve Jobs as saying that Apple was at the intersection of the liberal arts and a technical education. And I wonder if you could address very briefly this sort of STEM push from a policy standpoint and the importance of a liberal arts education. You've touched on it earlier, I think, but I do think your quote was very, very telling and very insightful.
Well, I use that because people, when you say that, you know, you have to have an education. It goes to the whole being of a man or a woman and having that be something that goes to them understanding and wrestling with the great questions of life. People start looking at you and their eyes glaze over and they think, oh, this doesn't sound right. I think it makes more sense if it's just for a job. And so what I always do is I quote Steve Jobs, because here's the guy who built the largest tech company right in the history of the world, Mr. STEM, if you will. And he was asked that, and he was saying, you know, that's what he said made Apple great, is that, you know, anybody, Oracle, Microsoft, all the great giants at the time would go out there and find the best and brightest, you know, computer science, coding, whatever degrees they could find, and bring them in. And Steve Jobs went out there, and he literally went and said, my focus is going to be on high-performing liberal arts majors who have that ability to think outside the box and wrestle with the great questions and sift through all that information and critically decide unique things. And so that's what he said. So he said he would grab those kids because his point was, and most people will tell you that when you meet with the big tech companies in California, they'll tell you, as Steve Jobs did, I can teach the coding part or the computer science part of that concept with a bright, well-educated, world-class educated liberal arts degree. I can teach that part in a year and a half or less. And so that's what Steve Jobs did, and that's what he would always say, is that why Apple is great, why we did things like an iPhone that nobody even thought of, is because we had those liberal arts minds working with their computer science expertise, and it just produced and changed the way people live.
I'd like to take that obvious passion that you have for education in general and talk about what has become a bill that's been talked about statewide, House Bill 7069, and you alluded to it earlier in the first part of our program. Sometimes there's some misinformation about it, so how about describing for our listeners some of the key elements, including I know you want to find world-class teachers and principals, and it's sweeping, and then we can focus on various aspects maybe of that bill.
Yeah, and so the concept again was, how do we, it's the most, I think, really even more important than anything else is fundamentally we ought to be able to deliver to our school children. And keep in mind, what I'm talking about is a public school bill. You know, sometimes it gets, you know, people throw around private schools. The bill was over $400 million, and I think a small fraction of it, Rick, went to private schools, and that part, supported by the public schools themselves, was for parents who have children with severe disabilities, and the current system isn't working for them, and so it created a Gardner scholarship that allowed them to go out there and get different kinds of treatments and educational benefits for their children. Every other penny of the $400 million went to public school system in the state of Florida.
You're listening to Richard Corcoran. He is the Speaker of the Florida House of Representatives. This is Policy Matters on WJCT, a special edition of the program just to be with the Speaker. I'm Rick Mullaney with the Jacksonville University Public Policy Institute. Mr. Speaker, one part of the bill that has gotten some attention, it has in Duval County and around the state, is the part dealing with charter schools. So can we talk about that piece of the legislation and how it relates to charter schools and what the schools of hope are in this legislation?
Yes. Yeah, so what we did is as you have a KIPP up here in Jacksonville, is we looked at those failure factories. And so these are just repeatedly DNF schools that aren't complying with any of the standards and giving the children a year's worth of learning. And so we went and looked at all of those schools that are in the turnaround mode and said, okay, and looked at how many. You know, in one of them, this is how staggering it is, Jefferson County. Jefferson County, the public school superintendent, the public school board, basically threw their hands up and surrendered and said, okay, we've been a failure factory for decades. So in other words, you dropped off your kid in kindergarten, they went there till 12th grade, their entire career was in a failure factory. And so finally they threw their hands up in the air and said, you know, and they converted it to a public charter school. All charter schools in the state of Florida are public, all of them. And so what they did is they converted to a public school. Now there's a group that's in there voluntarily. I mean, this wasn't anything that was forced upon them. They just said, we can't do it. And of course, they're still getting paid the $100,000 salary and the school board salary, even though now it's been turned over to a public charter school. The charter schools in there revolutionized, got rid of a lot of the faculty, which is another huge part of the bill, is we all recognize, it doesn't matter if you're a liberal or conservative, the most important aspect to a child learning in that classroom is going to be the person standing in front of them. And we don't do enough for our teachers. And so there was a huge component of creating bonuses, 3-year bonuses for every highly effective teacher. Of $1,200, $800 for effective teachers, and up to $6,000 or more if they're exceptional teachers based on certain metrics. And you can imagine if you're a school teacher and you graduate and you have a $30,000-some salary and then you're highly effective and you meet the metrics, now you're getting a $6,000 check. That's a car. You know, that's a game changer for a teacher, and it keeps them in the classroom where we want them to stay. We don't want them to leave and go do something else. And so all of that combined, we looked at what was going on in these low-income failing schools, and we said, how do we fix it? And we looked around the nation and found all of those great schools who have literally decades worth of success. And this is in New York, Boston, all these different areas, decades of success where they have kids that go and they have 90% graduation rate, 90% go on to college. All of them are provided a world-class education. And what we said to them is, what do we have to do to bring you here? And then we basically wrote the bill that did that.
We are very pleased to have on today's program Richard Corcoran. He's the Speaker of the Florida House of Representatives. We've been talking about public policy relating to education and the future of the state. In the second half of our program, we'll talk about the upcoming session of the Florida Legislature and some of the Speaker's top priorities. I hope you'll stay with us. I'm Rick Mullaney with the Jacksonville University Public Policy Institute, and you're listening to Policy Matters on WJCT 89.9 FM. Thank you for staying with us. I'm Rick Mullaney with the Jacksonville University Public Policy Institute, and you're listening to Policy Matters on WJCT 89.9 FM. We are very pleased to have a special edition for today's program because we have the Speaker of the Florida House of Representatives, Richard Corcoran. Mr. Speaker, again, thank you for being with us today here in Jacksonville.
No, thanks for having me.
In the first half of the program, of course, we focused a little bit on your pathway to becoming Speaker and talked about one of the great passions is public education. But I do want to shift the focus in the second half of the program to the upcoming session starting in January in 2018. What are some of your top priorities for the upcoming session in 2018?
Well, you know, we're going to continue doing the stuff that we did last year, which is continuing to go through the budget and make sure that we're getting rid of wasteful spending. We did a lot of that last year, to a record amount. We're going to continue to fight for transforming public education. So we've come out with a new bill this year that basically says we have, shockingly, over 50,000 reported incidents, probably more than over 100,000 or more incidents unreported, of kids who are subject to violence and abuse in the school system, and they're trapped. And we do know that when you take a child and they're afraid to get on the bus or go to school, they're not going to be learning a year's worth of learning. And again, that sets them back and they start losing that hope and dignity. So this year we've outlined a new program that basically says if you're a child that has been the victim of any kind of abuse or harassment, you're now eligible to get a scholarship and go to the school of your choice. And I think that'll be a game changer for those kids. And again, this will help us get to tremendous academic outcomes that we'd like to see in the state of Florida. And then we'll also we'll continue to do our best. We're number one in the entire nation for fiscal health. That's an amazing stat because we're the third largest state. And if you look at the other large states around us, California, New York, and Pennsylvania are all in the bottom five, while we're number one. And the closest to us is Texas, but they're like 27. So that's how staggering. The only one states close to us are, I always say, are small oil-rich states with oil underneath them, you know, South Dakota, Wyoming, what have you. That's how good we are in our fiscal health. And we got that way because we've cut $10 billion plus over 7 years. We have cut back on 5,000 regulations. And all of that in savings that we're giving out there into the community, into the businesses to go out there and be job creators has brought us back to where we're now seeing, 300,000 people move to the state of Florida, businesses, you name it, because this is the land of opportunity. And as long as we keep that in place, you're going to see that growth continue, and it'll give us more money to go back in and invest in hopefully public education and get that right where we can be number one in the nation, hands down, in public education.
Mr. Speaker, one of the first things you mentioned was the budget and spending. Earlier this week, on Tuesday, Governor Scott was in Jacksonville, and he announced his outline of his proposed budget for the upcoming year for 2018. One area, of course, was he's obviously big on jobs. It's been a focus of his during both terms as governor. And Visit Florida for both tourism and, of course, Enterprise Florida. In last year's session, fairly contentious, but in the end, it got through the session. In the upcoming session, he's put in roughly about $100 million for Visit Florida and also has allocated money, of course, for Enterprise Florida. What do you foresee in those two areas coming up in the upcoming session?
Well, I think, you know, last year we went through that process of scrutinizing and looking at these agencies. And so as to the governor's budget, what happened, I'll start with the summation sentence, and that is we came up with a solution that really works for the state of Florida. How we got there was maybe a little messy at times. But what we did is we looked, and so Visit Florida, it's an agency, first of all, that didn't even exist until 1996. And so I always joke, you know what we had before 1996, Rick? Tourists. you know, let's not pretend that this is the end all be all. So we always had it about $25 million. And the reason we created Visit Florida, I wasn't there, but historically knowing this, is because when you have those cataclysmic events that really cost tourism, when you have a Zika virus in Miami, when you have oil spill in the Gulf, that money was to be used to go out there and tell the world, tell the Europeans, tell the rest of America that, you know, the Zika virus is dead and is not a factor. There isn't a tar ball on one of our beaches. You know, get people to come back when there may be a perception that everything's awry in Florida. Well, it went from that $25 million and that purpose. Overnight, it jumped up, you know, literally in the last 6 years to about $76 million. And all we did was ask, okay, what are you spending the extra $76 million on? We'd like to know. At which point, Visit Florida told us none of our business because they said they're a public-private partnership. Keep in mind, 90% of their money comes from taxpayers. And so then we literally said, you're going to give it to us or else. They finally released it and they said, here's the deal. Only legislators can look at it. You can't make it public to the world because it's a trade secret. And if you do, we're going to prosecute you and even seek to have you put in prison or in jail because there's an attachment for a misdemeanor, of which point we sued in court and said to the court, release these documents. They were released in 24 hours. And sure enough, we found, you know, $1 million for a rapper pit bull to, you know, communicate with millennials, $2.5 million wrapping a race car. Probably the most egregious was almost $14 million was given to a producer to go out there and produce a show. One was Emerald and one was a fishing show. The guy got a $200,000 boat kickback that he still has that we've told him we want back, and now it's suddenly burned. And the producer, we said, we want all your documents to see how you spent the $14 million. He's lawyered up, won't give us any documents, and is now sued in court to try to stop us from getting the subpoenas being quashed, the subpoenas, so he doesn't have to turn over the documents. That tells me that we're going to win. We're going to get the documents. We're in the right. He's in the wrong. But I think that there's more than misspending money that's happening here with this gentleman. So my point is, all of that happened. So it was a good thing you look in there and you find and you see what this money's being spent on. Spent wisely, yes, we all support it, but this is taxpayer money. It's nobody else's. It's taxpayer money, and you can't take that out of someone's pocket and throw it around to your cronies and insider elites. And so I think where we got to last year with Governor Scott is now we created a completely entire oversight system. Now that the entering into contracts have to get certain amounts, have to get approval from the House and the Senate. Everything's transparent. Everything has to be posted online. And so now you'll have, now that you have that accountability, you have that transparency, you're going to have a better steward of the taxpayer money. Now what we're trying to do is take that same accountability, same transparency, and apply it to local governments.
Well, that's a nice segue into local governments, but I take it that for the upcoming session, the final numbers yet to be determined, but that you expect that we will be able to work this out in the upcoming session.
Yeah, so yeah. I mean, the concept of what we're all doing with VISIT and how, now that we have the transparency and accountability, I think we're all on the same page. What that amount ends up being is going to be just the negotiation through the budget process.
On the topic of taxing and spending, but also on education, can we talk a little bit about what you anticipate for funding for education? And particularly, you have seen some increase in property values. That's a good thing in the state of Florida. That tends to bring with it increased revenue. Some call that a good thing, too. Some may call that a tax increase. So how about discussing the funding for public education and what you expect in this upcoming session?
The governor's budget rolled out to the FEFP roughly a 4% increase. And I think last year we were just under 2%, somewhere in that ballpark, or right at 2%. So I think that you're going to see, we do it every year. I mean, apart from the Great Recession, we increase school funding every single year. So I think it'll be, you're going to see it somewhere fall in that frame. But there'll be, in addition to that, there'll be these additional programs that we'll do, like the Hope Scholarships, which are given to kids who are victims of violence or abuse. There'll be, you know, tens, if not $100 million spent on those programs. So you'll see a lot of money spent in public education. The big question, I think, is, as you alluded to, is we fund part of our educational funding with the required local effort, which is a property tax that has the local send it up. Well, what happens is that rate, because of property values rising, you send up more money. It's literally over $500 million now to the state of Florida. What we've done over the last 2 years is pay for that at the state level so that the locals didn't have to pay for that. And more importantly, that people didn't have their property taxes raised. And so we've done it 2 years in a row. We've all gone out, whether you're a senator or a House member, we've all gone out and championed it as a, you know, cutting their taxes and keeping them from having a tax increase. Every year there's somebody that says, you know, this isn't a tax increase. Let's take that money and spend it on whatever. But I think the House's position has been pretty clear that we're not going to raise taxes, and certainly off the back of property owners, to go out there and fund other projects that, that aren't as important as our public education.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to shift a little bit to what some might call a little bit of a crisis of confidence in local, state, and federal government. It's really not unique to Florida. And part of that, there are a lot of reasons, a lot of things contributing to it. But certainly one of your efforts last session, and may continue this session, is ethics reform and trying to instill some sort of confidence on the on what's going on in Tallahassee. Can we talk about that? Because that has become a very, very big topic, and having confidence of what's going on in Tallahassee.
Yeah, you know, that's what we, our class, when we took over, one of the big things we asked people is, who's the enemy? What, you know, if you're unhappy with your local, state, or federal government, what, who's the problem? Who's the source of that problem? Or, and quite frankly, who's the enemy? And what we said is the enemy is us. We're the enemies. You elect us to go up to office, and you get up there and you either act in a terrible, indiscriminate way, or you start having inappropriate relationships with the special interests. And so what we did is we passed the most sweeping, transformational, aggressive ethics rules in the nation, bar none. We put into our rules and said that you can't go out and have this revolving door where you serve as a legislator 1 year and the next year you're out lobbying. We put in a six-year ban. It's the longest and strongest ban in the nation. We said you couldn't fly on lobbyist planes or special interest planes or principal planes. You couldn't have contracts or business dealings with lobbyists or special interests. You couldn't be texted while you're sitting there in committee or you're sitting on the House floor and votes are being taken and take texts from lobbyists or special interests. We banned all of that. It was a sweeping reform, and it's made a big difference in the House. We also put in the strongest sexual harassment laws. We went back into our rules, applied it to lobbyists, and have some of the strongest sexual harassment laws. All of this we did because you got to clean up. You know, the whole point was you have to clean up your own house, and we have to go back there and fight to restore faith, get the people's faith in their government that their leaders are going to do the right thing. Damn the consequences, but always do the right thing.
You're listening to Policy Matters on WJCT 89.9 FM. I'm Rick Mullaney with the Jacksonville University Public Policy Institute. We're very pleased to have the Speaker of the House of Representatives for the state of Florida, Richard Corcoran, here today as our special guest. Mr. Speaker, you just mentioned some of the strong laws on sexual harassment. This topic has become a national topic, a statewide topic. It's sort of unfortunate when we take a look at what's going on around the country. One sort of question, this is at the national level, and then we'll talk about the state level. Certainly throughout the news right now is Roy Moore and what's been going on in Alabama. Your thoughts on that, and for example, do you think he should step down in his attempt to become the senator of Alabama?
I do, I've publicly said that he should step aside. I think that, you know, we live in one of the greatest countries. The reason we live in the greatest country in the world, more than any other reason, I tell people, is rule of law. We have a rule of law that is true and is just, and this is an example of that. So, yes, to the extent, but that's different than politics. It's, you know, there's a criminal justice point and there's a political point. And what you see here is a pattern of behavior over a long period of time. It's not an isolated incident or one incident. And so, yes, do I believe that everybody is due justice and proven innocent until proven guilty? All true. But in the political realm, when you're out there and you're holding yourself out and there's this litany or just a lengthy pattern of behavior that's questionable, that the right thing to do is to step aside.
And at the state level, of course, we've seen the chairman of the Senate budget with Senator Latvala, recently with allegations for a number of different women in Tallahassee. What are your thoughts on that controversy? And by the way, the allegations seem to be pretty serious. It's not so much, not like Mr. Moore's or Judge Moore's directly, but really go more to an abuse of what some people would call potentially abusing a position. What are your thoughts on that situation?
Well, I would say, Rick, that I think that being 32 years old and having an inappropriate relationship with a 14-year-old is in essence statutory rape in almost all 50 states, and deserve, if that is proven to be true, he shouldn't be walking the streets with us.
Are you talking about
and Roy Moore?
Yes, yeah, that's why I was making a distinction between him and the state of Florida with the senator here in Florida. Yes, I certainly agree with you on
that. Yeah, and so same thing with this with the senator. I believe, you know, and again, there's been an admission of kissing a lobbyist. There's been an admission of knowing about sexual misconduct. These aren't, you know, necessary to prove, but they've already been admitted of knowing about sexual misconduct and not following the proper procedures. In addition, there's now a complaint in the full Senate committee regarding sexual harassment, and there's six more anonymous that have hired lawyers and have been talking to the press about sexual harassment. Again, when you see a longstanding, you know, that pattern of behavior, I think that calls for someone to, in that situation, I think the right thing to do is resign. I've said that publicly in that case too. But you know, the Senate's put together a process. They have an outside lawyer, expert on sexual harassment from Tampa, who's investigating the anonymous complaints, and they also have in-house going through their legislative process. So I think that I have full faith and confidence that the process will work.
Mr. Speaker, we're short on today's time, but do you have any concluding comments for the people here in North Florida? It's been a pleasure having you on today's program about what's coming up in the session or your view for the state.
Well, I would just say don't hesitate to make your voice be heard. As a sitting legislator and sitting there talking to my colleagues all the time, the one thing that moves us more than anything else is when there's somebody in our district who calls us up and says this needs to change or that needs to change. It's still the most persuasive voice that we have in American politics.
Well, Mr. Speaker, that's the final word for today's program. Thank you for being with us. I want to thank our listeners. You've been listening to Policy Matters on WJCT 89.9 FM. I'm Rick Mullaney with the Jacksonville University Public Policy Institute. I hope you'll be with us again next time.